This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Joe Biden says that he's optimistic about America's vaccination pace, but warns the nation needs to keep taking the pandemic seriously. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
The president's touting 150 million vaccine doses administered since he took office, and he's telling states to make all adults eligible for shots by April 19th. At the same time, he's calling it a life and death race.
We still have a lot of work to do.
Noting cases rising and variants spreading. Both he and Dr. Anthony Fauci are urging states to hold off on lifting more health restrictions, with Fauci warning the country is on the brink of a virus surge.
Essentially tempting another wave.
Which Fauci said at a National Press Club event would not just be bad for public health, but also for the nation's psyche after more than a year of lockdowns. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Now, there are calls for the federal government to send more vaccines to five states that are currently virus hotspots with 44% of the nation's new COVID-19 cases.
The five states have nearly a quarter of the nation's population and are seeing a sharp rise in cases. New York, hardest hit. Mayor Bill de Blasio has been pushing the federal government to provide them with a larger vaccine allotment. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, who just received her vaccine, also asked for more doses, saying she can't further tighten restrictions, saying pandemic fatigue has people going out even more. Florida, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey are the other three states, making up 44% of the nation's latest increase. One expert says it makes sense to send extra doses to places where infection numbers are climbing, but it also cuts back on those states that are successfully controlling the virus. I'm Jackie Quinn.
And this is VOA News. A World Health Organization spokesperson says the organization does not back requiring vaccination passports for entry or exit into countries due to uncertainty over whether inoculation prevents transmission of the virus, as well as equity concerns. Margaret Harris also stated at a news briefing that the WHO now expects to review China's Sinopharm and Sinovac COVID-19 vaccinations for possible emergency use, listing around the end of April as more data is required. A top official at the European Medicines Agency says there's a causal link between the AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccine and rare cases of blood clots, but he says the benefits of getting the vaccine still outweighs the risk. The news came from Marco Cavalleri, head of health threats and vaccine strategy there. The EU agency said during a news conference that it may be held later this week. AstraZeneca and Oxford University, which developed the vaccine, announced Tuesday they were pausing the trial of their jabs in children while British regulators investigate the potential blood clot link in adults. The AstraZeneca vaccine is critical to Europe's immunization campaign and a linchpin in the global strategy to get vaccines to poor countries. The United States on Tuesday described indirect talks with Iran and Vienna as constructive and potentially useful step toward both sides resuming compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal that Washington abandoned 3 years ago. Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the deal in 2018, prompting Iran to steadily overstep the accord's limits on its nuclear program, designed to make it harder to develop an atomic bomb, an ambition Tehran denies. Tuesday's talks included a meeting of the remaining parties to the original deal, that's Iran, Britain, China, France, Germany, and Russia, in a group called the Joint Commission that is chaired by the European Union. The United States did not attend. The families of refugees and their supporters, including 124 elected officials, have sent U.S. President Joe Biden a letter urging him to make good on his promise to boost refugee admissions to the United States. Biden presented a plan to Congress 2 months ago to raise the number of admissions. Israel's president has handed Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu the difficult task of trying to form a new government that gives the embattled Israeli leader a chance to extend his lengthy term in office, but with a newly elected parliament deeply divided and a prime minister on trial for corruption, is little to celebrate. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, April 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Benin protesters say they no longer recognize President Talon as their leader.
The population have made clear to him that since his mandate is finished, he has no more power starting from 5th of April. And because of that, they have decided to disobey totally to his order.
Malawi teachers resume strike over COVID-19 risk allowances. Kenya retaliates against the United Kingdom for COVID-19 travel restrictions. A new study looks at the strengths of Chinese lending. And Tanzania's president orders the reopening of media houses closed under Magufuli.
Nasikia kuna vijivyombo vya habari huko mlivifungia fungia.
She said, I'm told you revoked licenses of some media outlets, including some online television stations. You should lift the ban, but tell them to follow the law and government guidelines.
And a record number of people in the Democratic Republic of Congo face acute hunger. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In Benin, protesters, including opposition political parties and civil society groups, say they no longer recognize President Patrice Talon as their leader. President Talon came to power in 2016 and said that he would serve only 1 5-year term. Now he's running for another term in Sunday's election. Protesters who took to the streets in many cities on Tuesday say they will no longer obey Talon as their president because his 5-year term expired midnight Monday, April 5th. Sadiku Ayo Alao is president of GERDES Africa, a research group on democracy and economic and social development in Africa. He says the revolution has begun and President Talon may be forced to step down in a few days' time.
As I told you last week, President Talon's mandate of 5 years ending since yesterday night at 12. Now, the population and the political parties and the political activists and organizations as well have made clear to him that since his mandate is finished, he has no more power starting from 5th of April. And because of that, they have decided to disobey totally to his order. And for all these people, is no more the president of Benin. And because of this situation, they are demonstrating in various towns of the country, and sometimes it leads to violence and destruction. And the police and the army seems to be understanding the people if they are not supporting them. And one could expect that by few days, I think the government of Talon will be forced to give up.
The presidential election is this Sunday, April 11. From the opposition point of view, do you think the elections on Sunday should take place?
The election may not be able to take place as planned because the people do not recognize any authority since President Talon is no more the president for them. And there will be probably a government of transition to settle the situation.
You and I spoke last month about the arrest of opposition politician Rekia Madugu. What is her status now? Is she still in jail?
She's still in jail, but there is a new element since, let's say, yesterday as well. A judge of the so-called court Create. And I told you about that court. I told you that it's not a court. It looks like an administration run by the President Talon himself to jail his opponent. And the magistrate of that court has just resigned yesterday and made public, I think, from abroad. He left the country. He said clearly that all the decisions that have been taken by this court have been always imposed by President Talon, giving instruction to the court. And in the case of Rekia, he confirmed that there is no legal reason why she could have been in jail. They only received instruction that she should be maintained in jail, and they do not have the right to analyze the reason for which she could be in jail. It means what we have been saying since a while, that Rekia Madugu did not do any criminal offense. The only reason why she is maintained in jail is because President Talon suspects her to have money to help the opposition party. And for that reason, since they did not find the money, she needs to be put in jail with strict instruction that she should not be able to talk with anybody or to meet anybody. But regardless of all this situation, what they wanted to avoid is happening. The revolution is on, and I don't see how they can stop it.
Sadiku Ayo Alao is president of GERDES Africa, a research group on democracy and economic and social development in Africa. He was speaking with us from the Benin capital, Cotonou. Malawi public school teachers have resumed a nationwide strike after the government backed out of a promise to pay bonuses for COVID-19 risk. Malawi authorities say the government has no money to pay the teachers who risk contracting the coronavirus by teaching classes in person. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi's public school teachers resumed their nationwide strike Tuesday after the government did not honor a promise to pay bonuses for their risk of contracting the coronavirus while on the job. President of the Teachers Union of Malawi, Willie Malimba, said they began the stop-work action after authorities failed to meet a seven-day ultimatum.
We felt cheated on this one because we agreed, and at that time it was a high-level meeting. We did that one at Parliament. So we had the Presidential Task Force. We had the Committee of Education when we were making that agreement.
Malimba said the teachers take risks when working in packed classrooms during the pandemic and will not resume work until the government gives them the promised bonus. But Malawi's government says teachers were not among those budgeted to receive a COVID-19 risk allowance. Malawi government spokesperson Gospel Kazako says despite what was promised, they do not have the money to meet the teachers' demands.
People can squeeze government. But if government doesn't have a resource, it doesn't have a resource. And you must know that we are not doing these things out of malice or that we are careless. No, we are not.
Kazako is also Malawi's information minister and a member of the Presidential Task Force on COVID-19. He says they will meet the teachers on Thursday to discuss their welfare, but not the bonus, which he argues would be short-term anyway.
Teachers have a lot of problems beyond COVID allowances. We need to sort out their salaries. We need to sort out their conditions of service. We need to sort out their housing allowances. So many other things, not just to be, COVID. The thing is, assuming in the next 3 months there is no COVID, it means they will not have an allowance.
Steve Shala specializes in education for the Nairobi-based nonprofit African Institute for Development Policy. He says the government should reach a deal with teachers so that Malawi's students don't lose any more class time.
It would be important for government to be quite open about what's going on. If they say there is no money, that's not enough an explanation. It's possible for the government to have no money, but to come up with an explanation that the teachers can understand and can compromise, and then they can resume work.
Malawi's teachers first began striking in January after months of being closed due to the coronavirus. They resumed work in February after the government promised to give them money to buy personal protective equipment. Malawi first closed the schools in March 2020, even before it confirmed its first cases of COVID-19. The government reopened the schools in September, only to suspend classes again in January after a surge in infections, including among some teachers and students. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Kenyan Airways has banned all passenger flights to and from the United Kingdom effective April 9th until further notice. This after Britain banned all flights operating between Nairobi and London following an upsurge in Kenya COVID-19 cases. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, Kenya has described the UK restrictions as discriminatory.
Last week, the United Kingdom announced travel restrictions against Kenyans traveling to the United Kingdom, saying Kenya has recorded a surge in the South African corona variant, a move that Kenyan government did not receive well. On Monday, The Kenya Airways announced the suspension of all passenger flights to the UK, citing adherence to the government directive of not travelling in and out of London. International relations expert Professor David Kikaya said that UK's move is malicious, given that Kenya has so far not recorded a large number of COVID-19 cases. He says the economy will still hurt.
Nairobi still stands as a hub for connectivity by a number of airlines, including British Airways. So it's going to be like a double-edged sword that cuts both ways, especially coming at a time when the Kenya government has just bailed Kenya Airways out of losses that have been precipitated by the instability in international economy, COVID notwithstanding.
The Kenyan government followed suit and restricted all the passengers from the UK and those transiting through UK, subjected them to mandatory quarantine at their own cost. They also must undergo mandatory COVID test at their own expense. They must have a valid COVID vaccine certificate as well as COVID negative certificate. Kenya also banned all the flight in and out of the UK for 1 month. Professor Kikaya says UK is ungrateful given Kenyans got the UK variant from many people coming in from British, among them Briton soldiers, coming in for the training.
Why you then punish Kenya for being hospitable to a people who this variant originates from their country? I think just that one beats logic.
Earlier, Kenya's health minister Mutahi Kagwe said that all decisions regarding countries in Europe, among them UK, will be made based on state interests.
We also are looking at the situation in the UK and elsewhere in Europe. And as you know, we have also gotten the UK variant in our country. We have noticed it also. So decisions will be made based on national interests and based on the science.
With these new measures, even the UK government officials and diplomats would be required to present valid COVID-19 vaccination certificates and negative COVID-19 tests before entering Kenya. Despite the COVID-19 wrangle between the two states, Nairobi and London enjoy strong ties. Recently, the two countries signed a trade deal that will see Kenya exporters accessing the UK market under duty-free. The deal also gives British businesses unrestricted access to the Kenyan market. I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Batty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, April 7th. Tanzanian President Samia Suluhu Hassan has ordered the reopening of media outlets that were closed or otherwise repressed under President John Magufuli, who died last month. In a further break from Magufuli, Suluhu Hassan said Tuesday that Tanzania will begin following scientific procedures in handling the coronavirus. Charles Kumbe reports from Dar es Salaam.
Tanzania's new President Samia Suluhu Hassan made the remarks at the State House Tuesday during an event to swear in newly appointed permanent secretaries. She ordered responsible authorities to lift a ban on all media outlets that were closed under the previous administration. She said, "I'm told you revoked licenses of some media outlets, including some online television stations. You should lift the ban, but tell them to follow the law and government guidelines," she said. She added, "Let us not give them a chance to say that we are limiting press freedom." In recent years, some Tanzanian media organizations were shut down for long periods of time after publishing material that apparently did not please the Magufuli government. Journalists in Tanzania are hopeful the president's remarks will lead to real reforms. Ibrahim Chawe is a journalist working with local government-owned media, Mlimani Media. I have received this news with big hopes that this can be a good beginning of press freedom and freedom of speech in Tanzania, he says. The president has said that the law should be observed, he says. But when you have a look at the laws or regulations that should be observed, still they are oppressive. Chawe went on to say he thinks this step of reopening the press should be an opportunity for new regulations and laws for running the press so as to create full freedom. Salome Kitomari of the Media Institute of Southern Africa in Tanzania An organization that defends freedom of expression believes that full freedom for journalists is coming soon. It has been a new hope, she says, because we all know there are some media outlets that were suspended because they were accused of breaking the law and regulations. Kitomari adds that we believe that with the president's statement, we are going to have the freedom to fulfill our responsibility according to the laws and regulations. On a separate issue, Hassan Tuesday also announced her intention to form a special committee to advise the government on steps to take in the fight against the coronavirus. The late president had denied that COVID-19 was a problem in Tanzania and questioned the efficacy of vaccines. Magufuli proposed the use of alternative therapies to treat the illness. Hassan's announcement on fighting the virus was welcomed by many, including opposition politicians. Abdul Nondo is a youth wing, national chairperson of the Opposition Alliance for Change and Transparency Party. Hassan shows us the way that we need to have a scientific direction, he said, and use scientific measures because for a long time our government has been using local measures. Nondo says Tanzania didn't have effective measures to combat and prevent the coronavirus pandemic, adding that many people died and the government failed to take any effective scientific measures to combat the pandemic. The full extent of COVID-19 in Tanzania remains unknown, as the government under Magufuli stopped counting cases and deaths in the early days of the pandemic. Charles Kombe, for VOA News, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
A new study released by the Center for Global Development looks at Chinese lending in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Scott Morris, one of the report's lead authors, explains to Ricky Stryak some of the strings that come with these loans.
You have China and the other countries who are members of the G20. That includes the U.S., the European countries. You know, they got together and created this thing called the Common Framework on Debt. And, you know, the goal there was to coordinate with each other as creditor countries in helping to address the debt stresses that developing economies are facing right now. So, you know, the key word there is coordination and cooperation. What we see in these Chinese contracts, though, are provisions that say, if we lend to you, a developing country, you are not allowed to seek cooperation if things go badly. So, you know, what we see in terms of the Chinese behavior in their contracts is really a unilateral approach, is to say, you know, we will work directly with the borrowing countries, but we don't intend to coordinate with others. You know, that just creates at best a tension, and it certainly raises a big question of what's real here. Is it what we're observing in these legal contracts, or is it the commitment that the Chinese government has made to the G20 to be cooperative?
How are some of these effects felt by residents of these countries?
On the one hand, infrastructure investment is really critical. You know, they need infrastructure to grow as economies, to create jobs, to reduce poverty. And, you know, China clearly has been a major source of this sort of investment. And what we see in these contracts, in a sense, is this is what it takes to get the Chinese to come in. All of these sort of special provisions that protect the Chinese investment. But again, you know, we should recognize that in a lot of cases, that has some good effect in terms of economic growth, where countries get into trouble and, you know, where it actually has a direct effect on whether it's African citizens or in other developing countries is, you know, you look at a case like Zambia right now, which is, you know, clearly has unsustainable debt, but they're having a really hard time finding a way to coordinate with all of their creditors to work out, you know, some arrangement that eases the debt burden. And to some degree, you know, it's not all on China's lap. You have a challenge with commercial creditors, too.
My last question is how these debt agreements have an effect on other creditors.
The big area here are, you know, what we observe in terms of these, you know, so-called escrow accounts or special accounts where under the contract, the borrowing country agrees to dedicate some, you know, revenue stream, some financial resources to an account that is essentially out of their hands. And that has a real effect on other creditors because if things get challenging for the country, it is a way for the Chinese lender to have special access to a payment stream, even if, you know, the country is saying to all of its creditors, we can't make these payments anymore. So that, you know, that creates pretty significant suspicions. And, you know, the longer term worry is that it may scare off future lenders if they feel like Chinese lenders are getting a special deal.
That was Kurt Morris, lead author for the new study, How China Lends. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Washington, D.C. The World Food Program reports a record 27.3 million people in the Democratic Republic of Congo are facing acute hunger and in urgent need of food aid. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The latest UN report, which analyzes the severity of food emergencies worldwide, finds one-third of the Democratic Republic of the Congo's people are critically short of food. The World Food Program, which provides life-saving food aid to nearly one-third of the more than 27 million hungry people, says this humanitarian disaster is largely man-made. It says conflict is a key cause of hunger in DRC, with the conflict-affected eastern provinces and the central region of the Kasais being the worst hit. WFP spokesman Thompson Feary says other factors are compounding this crisis, one being the DRC's collapsing economy, which has suffered from the COVID-19 pandemic.
Behind these numbers are harrowing accounts of families who have been deprived access to their land or have been forced to flee for their lives, watching their children fall sick for lack of food. WFP staff have met families who have returned to their villages to find entire compounds completely destroyed and their crops looted and remains burnt.
Fury says many people are surviving by eating wild roots or cassava leaves boiled in water. He says people most at risk of acute hunger are the 5.2 million internally displaced people, the largest number in Africa. He says some of the more than 500,000 refugees in the country, mainly from the Central African Republic, are particularly vulnerable. Other at-risk populations, he says, include female-headed households, the urban poor, and malnourished children.
WFP needs notably to be able to continue its work in the prevention and treatment of malnutrition, which affects 3.3 million children. Malnutrition in early childhood affects children for the rest of their lives, impairing their ability to realize their full potential and to contribute in their communities.
The World Food Program is appealing for $661 million to implement its life-saving program this year. The money, it says, will prevent millions of those most at risk from plunging deeper into hunger, despair, and possible death. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Authorities in Sudan say at least 40 people were killed and 58 injured during 3 days of clashes between ethnic groups in West Darfur. Sudan's military has vowed to restore peace to the region. Naba Mohideen has details from Khartoum.
The clashes between Arab and Masali tribes began a few days ago in Al Jineina, the capital of West Darfur state. The government declared a state of emergency in West Darfur Monday after the clashes continued for a third day. The Committee of West Darfur Doctors confirmed the death toll and called on the government to secure access for the committee to collect full figures. Sugar says the committee counted 50 people killed in the violence, and the number of casualties and death toll reached 132 people, and there are many others killed and injured people. The committee couldn't count as a result of access being blocked due to the bad security situation. The conflict started when two young men from the Masali tribe were killed Saturday. Militia fighters from Masali and Arab tribes fought in Al Jineina, using heavy weapons and vehicles. Sudan's Security and Defense Council accused unnamed armed militias with fueling the conflict. Defense Minister Major General Yassin Ibrahim says the government is taking steps to end the fighting. Yassin says all of the security apparatuses have been authorized to resolve the tribal conflicts. He says a higher committee will be formed from local councils to deal with all of the breaches in the peace agreements. Naba Mohideen for VUA News, Khartoum.
And that's it for this Wednesday, April 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barton in Washington saying, have a good day.